The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. My name's Louise Douglas. I'm one of the assistant directors here at the National Museum. Welcome on this very cold Canberra afternoon, and I'm particularly feeling sorry for the Queenslanders amongst us. Before I do anything, I will acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the land on which we have invited you to join us today, and acknowledge the Ngunnawal people as the traditional custodians of that land. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city, Canberra. We'd also like to acknowledge and welcome any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might be here today. Some housekeeping: the forum's being recorded for audio on demand. There's some questionnaires, the inevitable evaluation form is there for you, and right now, turn your mobile phones off. This is the moment that you do that. This forum is one of three interconnected projects reflecting the museum's current interest in exploring and documenting Australian identity. We have, of course, been interested in Australian identity from our inception, and most particularly when we opened the museum in 2001 with a major exhibition called Nation, which looked at the informal and formal symbols of Australian identity. But we, of course, have continued to be interested in this topic. Most recently, in the last 2 years or so, the museum's been delighted to have a partnership with Richard White and Melissa Harper, which has generated a book, an exhibition, and this forum here today. The book is a co-publication with New South Books, and we are launching it directly after this forum, and you're all invited to come to that launch, which will be about 5 o'clock, 5:30, up in the Friends Lounge. So just follow one of us and join in, but that's when we'll be officially launching the book. The exhibition is on a national tour, and it's currently, I think, just about to open in Albury as we speak. For today's forum, we're very lucky to have Richard White and Melissa Harper here today, who have been such central figures in the book, the exhibition, and now the forum. We've also got three additional contributors here, Peter Sperrett, Shino Kanishi and Linda Thompson, who will each give us a snapshot of the Harbour Bridge, the Billy, the Kangaroo, the Rainbow Serpent, Cooey and the Opera House. There will also be an opportunity for Q&A at the end of the presentations, and our MC, Rod Quantock, is going to weave his special magic through the afternoon. When we started to think about who should facilitate this forum and who would have that magic, the idea that we should take a light-hearted look at the symbolism and iconography of Australian identity was very much in our minds. And we thought that someone who had recently developed a show called Bugger the Polar Bears, This Is Serious, might be the right man. You, of course, know Rod as a pioneer of stand-up comedy over the last 30 years. He's been in many, many, many significant television shows: Australia, You're Standing In It, Fast Forward, Denton, Backburner, The Big Gig and Good News Week. You may not know, however, that he's received a very serious arts bouquet in the form of a Sydney Meyer Performing Arts Award in 2004 for his individual contribution to Australian cultural life. Although he's been around for a while, he's remained amazingly contemporary, evolving and staying at the forefront of the craft. And for me, there isn't anyone more provocative or piercing when it comes to commenting on climate change or any of the other major issues confronting Australian society today. So please join me in welcoming the magic Rod Quantock.
Thank you very much, Louise, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. the unemployed who we have here this afternoon. Some of you are just on the happy side of deceased, and we welcome you. And this may well be the last public event you go to, so we will make it a doubly engaging, we hope. Well, we're here today to talk about, at this stage, this new book, Symbols of Australia, which will be available to you today at a very special price. Later in the afternoon, we will officially launch this book. But to give you an idea of... to actually tell you what's in the book and what are considered symbols of Australia. And I'll just run through them. The Southern Cross, the Kangaroo, the Crown, the Map of Australia, Kui, postage stamps, the Gum Tree, Sharks, the Boomerang, the Billy, Miss Australia, which could only be an Australian symbol, the flag, the coat of arms, the wattle, the digger, Australia House in London, Vegemite you'd expect to be there, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Lifesaver, the Pavlova, the Holden, Uluru, Sydney Opera House, the Akubra, the Rainbow Serpent and the Baggy Green. Now, I'm from Melbourne and this book already affronts me deeply. I was born in 19... and the year that... the year that the first Holden ran off the production line in Melbourne. So in a strange sort of way, that universal Australian car has its birth in Melbourne. But that's about it, really, for Melbourne. Just to give you an idea, the front cover, or the front image here in the opposite the introduction to the book, is an image created from Australian postage stamps of the Sydney Opera House. The Sydney Opera House and the Harbour Bridge are both considered symbols of Australia, and that's fair enough. But Sydney does predominate. And the thing that really pissed me off in the end is that the Gum Tree is represented as a symbol of Australia, but you couldn't have taken a picture of a gum tree in Melbourne or Canberra. We had to get a gum tree in front of the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. So it's controversial, and if it isn't controversial, I'm about to make it controversial, because something like this, symbols, and look, there are people who will speak to you later on who will speak with much more authority about the role of symbols in a society, but they are very powerful. They exist because of a common agreement that they represent something about the place, the people and the society, and that's fair enough too. And it's, look, it's not a big book. You can't fit every symbol in, but you could have, I thought, a little bit kowtowed, and I don't know what you've got in Canberra that would stand as a symbol. But, you know, if you put your heads together, what are the symbols of Canberra? Where do we go? Parliament House? Yeah, but no. What's that?
It's in a hill.
It's buried. Yeah, no, it's a good idea. A few more layers of earth on it and it would be a much better place altogether. So it will become a talking point, because there are so many symbols that we could choose from. And for me, if I was asked, not that I was, I mean, all of this happened well before anybody contacted, it would be a very different book if I'd been asked to contribute to it. Because I think one of the, for me, and again, this is perhaps a reflection of my age, the teddy bear biscuit should be in here. And thank you, old people. And for a number of reasons, most significantly because the teddy bear biscuit, even though the teddy bear itself is a foreign construct created in England to amuse the children of the upper class, it was Australia that turned that into an edible biscuit. And we made it universal. And there was a time up until the 1970s when you could not get a better biscuit than the teddy bear biscuit. High on the hill of Parliament House, or in the drawing rooms of Government House, the teddy bear biscuit would be on display for visiting dignitaries from around the world to say, "Welcome to Australia." Now, that's all changed. The teddy bear biscuit was invented in Melbourne by a man named Mr. Guest. It was called Guest's Teddy Bear Biscuit. They were bought out by Arnott's, an Australian family company, who continued to manufacture them to the same specifications that Mr. Guest provided us with. And then, about 10 years ago, Campbell's, a foreign multinational food conglomerate, consumed our biscuit-making technology and took over the teddy bear biscuit. Has anybody had a plain teddy bear biscuit in the last 10 years since the Americans have been making them? Anybody had a plain one? Put your hand up if you have. Anybody at all? What do you eat up here? Do you live on the fat of the land? Don't... well, Well, I'm telling you now, they changed our biscuits. They are not only smaller, but they are harder. They are an economically rational biscuit. And I remember when they were free-range biscuits, when they came in tins, and you could walk into a local grocer shop, a man or a woman who knew you by name and never said, "Have a nice day," and you could buy one teddy bear biscuit, or an ounce or a pound. Not like today where you go into a supermarket and you buy those teddy bear biscuits and they sit in there in their cellophane packets, front to back, front to back, front to back, front to back, like some gay teddy bear Mardi Gras. No, they're gone. They've changed. And as a symbol of Australia, it's rather sad that we really can't claim them here. They were subsumed in the end by the culture of chocolate and the Tim Tam biscuit. That was introduced in 1972, I think, and that was the end of the plain biscuit and the changes to the way that we live. The other great symbol, which is very much part of my culture, not personally, but the culture that I come from, is the stubby. The stubby is an Australian invention. We invented the stubby. And within seconds we went, "Oh shit, that's cold," and we invented the stubby holder. We're the people who invented wine in a box, so you could look like an executive on the way to swimming in your own vomit. We are the people who invented the screw top for wine, so you could get at it quicker. This is why we don't have a space program. We're too busy inventing better ways of dealing with alcohol. So symbols are symbols are symbols, and they are different for all of us. And many of you, and maybe all of you, will agree that everything in this book is a true and honest symbol of Australia. And look, you can't deny it, they are. But any publication like this obviously omits much. And I hope that as this exhibition swells and grows and that this museum continues on its merry way, that you make representations on behalf of your favourite symbol. Has anybody got a symbol that wasn't mentioned in the book that I haven't mentioned?
Iced Vovo.
Iced Vovo. We should have a whole book of biscuit symbols. I can see this coming. You had one down there? The MCG. Now, I agree. I mean, much more important than the Opera House. Absolutely. They put opera on in the MCG. It's a multi-purpose cultural icon. But they keep pulling it down and rebuilding it. And as an icon, it morphs a great deal. But if there is one symbol of Australia that would be endorsed by John Howard, God rest his soul, it would be the MCG or the Sydney Cricket Ground. So as you go through the proceedings today, keep in mind what you would like to consider a symbol. I don't know whether the evaluation forms you'll get will have a big box at the bottom saying what was left out, but you make your own box of what was left out. Be rebellious. That's another symbol of our country. Deep within the core of every one of you lounging, lazy people who've got nothing better to do on a Wednesday afternoon, there is a rebel. And we would like you to drag that rebel out and challenge our assumptions about what symbols are. So this afternoon, we are going to introduce to you a number of contributors to this book. And at the end, we'll invite them. You can see their names there. We will invite them to the stage and we will open the forum to your piercing and probing questions. And I hope they do pierce and probe. Now, I'm going to introduce to you the first of our contributors, and each chapter in this book, or each symbol has its own chapter, is accompanied by the name of the person who wrote it and has given a lifetime of study to this particular symbol. And our first is Peter Sperrett. Peter is a professor of history at the University of Queensland who used to share a post office box with me back in Clifton Hill in Melbourne when he was free and easygoing. He's the author of a number of books, including The Sydney Harbour Bridge, A Life, published on the 75th anniversary of the bridge's opening in 2007, and the prize-winning, guess what the prize-winning book was? Sydney Century. What a horrible man. He has also co-curated a number of major exhibitions. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Peter Sperrett, one of the great contributors to this wonderful book. Peter, welcome.
In deference to Rod, I'll point out that my opening image, which was used to market Australia in California in the 1930s was dreamt up, or was commissioned by a guy called Charles Holmes, who ran the Australian National Travel Association, the publishers of Walkabout, and he hired all these fantastic poster artists in the 1930s, including Gert Selheim, Percy Tromp, Eileen Mayo, and Northfield. So in the 1930s, obviously, the bridge sort of captures the Australian imagination, but it also becomes a very important part of our international promotion. Now, theoretically, you'd think that there are lots of bridges around the world. Why would this one work so well? And I guess one of the things I try and argue in the chapter is that it's a combination of its sort of topographical setting and also the fact that there's no competition for it. So some of you will know that in New York, as soon as they found that Sydney was building the world's largest arch bridge, the longest and the widest, what did the bastards do? They built the Bayonne Bridge from Staten Island to New Jersey. They started it later, they finished it earlier, and they made it 25 inches longer. I mean, how mean can you get? Interestingly, though, an interesting comment on sort of bridge technology at the time, the Bayonne Bridge has never had a high profile in New York because there are 20 fantastic bridges around Manhattan Island. And an interesting comment on the two cultures at the time, the Bayonne Bridge was and still is 6 lanes, only carries road traffic. When the Harbour Bridge is conceived, it was going to have 4 lanes of railroad and was primarily going to be a railway bridge in the first instance. Of course, anybody who gets stuck in traffic now on the Spit Bridge would be very resentful of the fact that the railway line to Narrabeen was never built. So in the iconography of the 1930s, which I go through in the chapter, the bridge becomes very dominant. I guess the ultimate insult to Melbourne is that Percy Tromp, Melbourne's greatest poster artist, did a poster that we reproduce in the book in 1930 where he has a beautiful drawing of the bridge being built and the caption is "Still Building Australia." On to Rod's territory. So, what have we got here? This is a TAA route map, 1958. Like Rod, I deduce that at least half the people here were alive in 1958. Congratulations to you. What a desultory collection. Let's face it, how desultory can you get? We've got Colonel-like statue. Who remember who Colonel? Nobody under 30 has heard of Colonel-like, I regret to tell you. I mean, Perth, it still looks pretty dull. Hobart's being improved by the erection of the Sheraton Hotel. There's the Provisional Parliament House, which in my view was always going to be Canberra's greatest claim, having a nationally recognised symbol. It was in every textbook published in Australia from the late 1920s onwards. Brisbane's still in trouble. Melbourne, what can you say about Melbourne? I mean, it's pretty woeful. The point I make in my chapter in the book about Sydney is that this is 1958, remember. As you can see, the Harbour Bridge pylons are filthy, absolutely filthy. They weren't, that's Maria granite, but all you Canberrans will know. You can still visit the quarry where the granite comes from, Maria. They didn't steam clean those pylons until the early 1960s. So I argue in the chapter, I guess, that the bridge went through a period where it was very, very utilitarian. People just simply weren't interested. One of the drawbacks you can imagine of having devoted, correctly according to Rod, a bit too much of my life to the Harbour Bridge is that you're forever looking for new images. And as this session today is taking place in the National Museum, I have to confess to you that this image has been semi-illegally downloaded from eBay by my colleague Adrian Young. I've got to blame somebody, about 3 hours ago, although I was a successful bidder for this route map. Okay, now this is really what Rod's complaining about. Those of us who've come here via Qantas have been confronted with this kind of, what would you call this? This is a last-ditch attempt by the New South Wales government to save itself. This is its current advertising campaign. Some of you might also have seen the television version where you have lots of necessities and things in it. But this is kind of typical of the Sydney braggart tone. It's a challenge to all the other cities that they're always laying down. And this comes from the Qantas in-flight magazine for June, but this is part of a very big campaign for the government to save itself. It reminds me a little bit of Barry Unsworth thinking that the Darling Harbour development would save his government, and just to remind you, it didn't, nor did the bicentennial celebrations. So, is there a Melbourne reply? And I haven't got permission from the editors yet, but obviously if we do a new edition, I think that it's pretty clear to me that we'll have to ask Rod to write up this one. Okay.
Yes.
Righto. Comes from The Age and the Fairfax this weekend. Now, although I have to admit, as also a part-time student of tourism in Australia, that the Jigsaw Melbourne tourism campaign down the bottom left has without doubt been Australia's most successful state-based tourism campaign for 20 years now. What kind of reply is that? I mean, how many of you know who designed that mini Eiffel Tower structure in the middle? Does anybody know? Very well cited, yep. So this is the continuing dilemma. And in discussion over lunch today, we were still arguing that Flinders Street Station and the Melbourne Tram are probably Melbourne's two best prospects for inclusion in a book called Symbols of Australia. It's really hard to see I don't think you could describe that as classic graphic art or even very inspiring advertising myself. So I'll leave it there for further debate. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. And look, in defence of that appalling spire, Roy Grant originally designed it to be sheathed in copper. And it was going to be a really elegant building, but the cost of copper went through the roof, and now with the 40% tax on the mining industry, it's inconceivable that it would ever be done. But they, in the end, decided on a Lego concept for the tower, and what it was is just white Lego sticks to put that tower together, which amazed no one and attracted not one single tourist. So during the Kennett years, and some of you are probably refugees from the Kennett years, for any of you too young to remember Jeff Kennett, he was the love child of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. He insisted that it be lit by computer-operated lights. So they begin at the bottom and they go up to the top, and then they swirl around and back down they come. And you can go down there any night of the week and see literally no one looking at them. So it does raise the question, which we might raise towards the end, can you actually deliberately go about constructing an icon? But now I'd like to introduce our next presenter and co-editor of Symbols of Australia, Melissa Harper, who will talk about Billy T. Melissa completed her FD in history at the University of Sydney and now lectures in Australian Studies at the University of Queensland. Do you know Peter? You would, wouldn't you? He's loud. Her book, The Ways of the Bushwalker on Foot in Australia, 2007, explores how bushwalkers have engaged with the landscape through leisure. She is currently working on a project that examines... Now, listen for this. This is one of those wonderful things you can do. The rise of fine dining in Australia since the 1970s. These are the sort of sacrifices that Melissa makes for our culture. Come on, waddle up here, Melissa. Waddle away. Please welcome Melissa Harper.
Well, this is not so much talking about fine dining today, but something rather more humble in looking at the Billy and Billy Tea. And perhaps it's a symbol that doesn't have a great deal of currency in Australia today, but certainly something in the past operated very much as a symbol of Australia. And for something as mundane, something as humble as a tin can, I mean, the Billy has generated an awful lot of debate, something that national symbols do quite a bit. They do, as we've seen, generate quite a lot of debate. And it's something that's been invested with a potent range of meanings. And it's some of those debates and meanings that I just want to focus on today. I looked at these in more detail in the chapter, but I'll just sort of give you a bit of an indication of how the Billy's worked. Now, most people agree that the Billy became established as an essential item of bush equipment during the 1850s gold rushes, though many date its origins a decade earlier. You know, some take it even further back. But the more heated debate concerns the origin of the term Billy itself. And there's a range of explanations that have been put forward here. The most common theory is that it came from a French term, woolly, which referred to a tinned beef soup, which was popular on the goldfields. So the empty tins provided a suitable pot to boil water for tea. So that's one explanation. Another is that it derived from billa, which is an Aboriginal word, meaning creek or river, and thus water. A third, that it comes from the Scottish billy pot for cooking pot, or bally for milk pail. The most intriguing possibility is Russell Ward's proposal that it was a diminutive of William, named after King William IV, who sat on the throne between 1830 and 1837. So you've got a range of different possibilities here, French, Indigenous, Scottish, you know, or English. A whole lot of different possibilities about where the Billy came from, and it's something that's still argued about. So whatever its beginnings, by the late 19th century, the Billy had become indelibly linked with Australia. Every bushman, it seemed, carried one. Some carried more, nested one inside the other. So you'd have a tea billy, a billy for cooking meat, perhaps a third for carrying water. Now, the practical value of the billy to the bush traveller is obvious, but it doesn't really explain the fondness, the sort of sense of romanticism that developed around the billy, the way in which many bushmen kind of almost developed this romantic attachment. The billy became a bit of a love object for bushmen, as in the 19th century. So why is it that a tin can, a humble tin can, should be put on such a pedestal? And I'd suggest that in the chapter that the answer lies in its symbolism, in its evocation of a particular understanding of Australianness and a widespread desire to connect with it. So the billy was seen as something that was very democratic. It was used very widely. It wasn't just used on the road. It was also something that was used in houses as well. So men and women used the billy, black and white people also used it, workers, as in swagmen, but also leisure seekers. It became something that bushwalkers also made widespread use of. But it was its association with the bushman, and particularly with the swagman, as we see here, that really gave it national meaning, that really made it a symbol of the nation. Now, in the last two decades of the 19th century, artists and writers identified the bush as the real Australia, and the bushman, you know, particularly the sort of the bushman that took to the road, as the real Australian. So Australians from all walks of life imagined that they could identify with the distinctive landscape and this kind of life of independence and hardship that entailed by a life in the bush. And that life was said to have fostered a distinctive Australian character, one that was practical, laconic, egalitarian. And so it was in this context that the billy came to stand for the nation. In sketches of bush life that featured in illustrated newspapers, in a whole range of stories and poems of people like Henry Lawson, Banjo Patterson, Joseph Furphy, etc., in the art of the Heidelberg School, and in bush ballads and folk songs, somewhere there was always nearly a reference to the billy. Now, rarely did the billy take centre stage. It was usually just simply there, almost a kind of obligatory motif to establish the authenticity of the scene. So the swagman on the tramp was depicted carrying a billy or dangling it from his swag. When he stopped for a midday smoko or arrived for the evening camp, a fire would be built. The billy was filled with water and set to boil. And so waiting for the billy became a very kind of... waiting for the billy to boil became a very sort of precious moment in the day for the swagman or for the traveller. It was a moment for quiet, a time for reflection, and also for rest. The sight of a boiling billy was also an invitation to a passing traveller to throw down his swag and share a mug of the hot brew. So the billy symbolised hospitality and the sociability that was widely seen as a hallmark of the Australian bush. And it's also around the boiling billy that the great Australian yarn was spun. So Henry Lawson wrote his short stories in the glow of that bush tradition. And when he published the first major collection of his work in 1896, he called it While the Billy Boils. Now, the ability to make a good brew was very much something that was seen as a sign of a good bushman. And again, there's a lot of argument here. This is where the debate about billies and billy tea comes in, about how to actually make a good pot of billy tea. So connoisseurs debated when it was best to add the tea leaves, whether the tea should be stirred with a gum twig, how long it should actually sit, whether it was necessary to swing the billy. There's probably, I'm sure, plenty of people in the audience here who've swung a billy and regard themselves as experts at such thing. I've never tried it and I don't think I ever will. I'm sure I just burned myself. There were also arguments over whether it was better to hang the billy over a fire or to stand it in the embers. The experienced bushmen always filled their billy to the brim because they knew that if it was only half full, the rim was going to burn off soon enough. And bushmen competed with one another as to who could boil the billy the fastest. And the blacker the billy was, the more quickly it would boil. So men kind of really took pride in the blackness of the billy, partly because it did have superior boiling qualities, but also because an old blackened billy signalled the old hand as opposed to the new chum. It showed that you were really part of the bush and knew what you were doing. So that it was not sort of spick and span spoke of that nonchalance that was supposed to define the Australian character. And with such qualities, it's no surprise that it became, as I've suggested, the bushman's mate. And some of the more sentimental bush ballads of the 20th century really did kind of border on love poems to the billy. But the billy also symbolised, so you've got this kind of loving relationship with it, but it also symbolised the ambivalence that Australians felt towards the bush. So as often as the billy was something that provided comfort and reassurance and hospitality, the billy also signalled or symbolised the struggles that went hand in hand with bush life, as you get a sense of here in this sketch by Julian Ashton, He's Lost, a sketch from Riverina in 1880, and perhaps one you're more familiar with, Frederick McCubbin's Down on His Luck from 1889. So you really get a sense here of the sort of hardship of the bush. You know, the billy lies very, it's on its side, carelessly there on its side, discarded. So the fact that the billy, not even the billy, could provide the usual solace indicated the kind of utter helplessness of an unfortunate bushman's predicament. But the association between the billy and death found its clearest voice in Australia's quasi-national anthem, Waltzing Matilda. And it's to the song that the billy owes much of its symbolic status, and equally the song owes as much to the billy, or at least to Billy T. There's a very interesting story behind this. And here again you've got a lot of argument and debate around Waltzing Matilda. I mean, both the origins of the lyrics and also the music have been the subject of heated debates, complicated by the fact that there are a number of versions of the song. But the most commonly accepted account of its creation is that the lyrics were written by Banjo Paterson in 1895, and he was by then a well-known poet, with Christina McPherson, who was a station owner's daughter, and Banjo Paterson was staying with her family at the time in Queensland. And rumour had it that he fancied Christina, and they sat down and wrote this tune and lyrics for the song. Now, Paterson introduced the billy in the first verse, so he had the line, and he sang as he looked at his old billy boiling. But this was actually the only mention of the billy in Paterson's version. In the chorus, he opted for the far less romantic water bag. The version of Waltzing Matilda that was to become the standard had its origins as an advertising ploy for Billy T. Now, Billy T was something that was started to be imported in the late 1880s, and from the 1890s, this is the package advertising that you're, or the packaging that you're having. So you've got a swagman drinking his Billy T, talking to a kangaroo who's carrying a swag and a billy. So all those iconic images are there. And the head of the company importing the tea, James Inglis, planned to give away some of the sheet music for Waltzing Matilda with each packet of the tea that was sold. But he wanted the lyrics of the song to be rejigged. I mean, it's hardly fitting to have a story associated, the associated tea with death, as a choice for, you know, when you're trying to market a beverage as a refreshing and uplifting brew. So the lyrics needed to be reworked. They needed to be changed. And the task of commercialising the song fell to Marie Cowan, who was the wife of Inglis's manager. She added the word jolly, so once a jolly swagman, to the opening line, and she injected Billy into the chorus. So you're getting that repetition and the association with the product. And she also capitalised the B. So what you get here is the song, the tea and the Billy coming together and helping to sort of firmly secure the popularity of all three. So the symbolic power of the Billy lies in the way it embodied the mythology of the bushman. I mean, like him, the Billy was seen as dependable, resourceful, practical and egalitarian. But what of the Billy today? Does it still have a great deal of currency? I mean, I'm not sure that it does with kind of younger Australians who, when I talk to them anyway, students of mine, don't necessarily know what a Billy actually is. Bushwalkers and campers, I mean, they lament the fact that the restrictions on fire in national parks have taken away the opportunity to boil a billy on an open fire. But on the other hand, it does continue to be used in the outback. It's certainly something that is used in outback tours, for example, as a kind of way of, you know, which tourists are kind of given this supposedly authentic experience of Australia's bush. You can still buy billy tea in supermarkets. Waltzing Matilda remains a popular song sung at sporting matches, for example. So you still have a range of ways in which the billy is given some currency in contemporary Australia, and yet I'd suggest that for all the symbolic value of the billy, it really lies as much, its sort of ongoing power lies as much with its nostalgia for a bygone Australia. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa. And it's a fantastic ad for the billy tea, a man talking to a kangaroo, and I wondered whether what was in the cup or what was in the pipe that encouraged him to do that. But they were the good old days when you could talk to kangaroos. And now we're going to talk about kangaroos. What a terrific segue that was, Rod. We're going to introduce you to Linda Thompson. There's Linda up there, kangaroo. Linda completed an arts degree at the University of Sydney with joint honours in art theory and history in 2008. Her area of interest, European art and Australian history. Her honours thesis, examining how travel to artistic centres has influenced Australia's art. She is currently studying law. Another overachiever. She is currently studying law at the University of Sydney. So to talk to us about our kangaroo, please welcome Linda Thompson. Linda, welcome.
Whether it's a boxing kangaroo, the Australian-made symbol, or Skippy the Bush kangaroo, I would argue that there are few symbols, perhaps even in this whole book, which are as unambiguously Australian and unique as the kangaroo. And I'm sure you've all spent hours poring over the kangaroo chapter in the book, or you're about to do that, so I'm not going to go through the same arguments already there, but I thought I'd give us a bit of a best of the kangaroo so that we can reflect on how it came to hold its strong position as a symbol of Australia today. I would suggest that symbols don't begin their life self-consciously, usually. So Vegemite was just a beer waste product, or surf lifesavers were just doing their job, and the kangaroo had similar humble beginnings in Australia. Now, I've done a fair bit of research in this area, and I'm fairly confident that if you were to summarise all of the early interactions with kangaroos from Europeans, it would go something along the lines of, oh my gosh, what the hell is wrong with that animal? And a response along the lines of, yeah, this place is really, really weird. And that's because for the first white settlers and the interested public back home in England, the kangaroo was pretty much, it was just another symptom of a weird and wonderful Antipodean area. Kangaroos were taken back to England and they were bred in captivity and they were paraded across, pretty much across the British Empire as a mysterious and odd animal. And whilst it was all very well for people in England to be breeding kangaroos, back home in Australia, they were pretty much the opposite. They were a huge pest. They destroyed vegetation, they damaged water supplies, And the eastern states in Australia eventually passed legislation calling for the eradication of the kangaroo. And there was millions and millions of kangaroos killed each year by the end of the 19th century. What I think is interesting at this point, however, when everyone is consciously targeting the kangaroos as something to kill, and they're being culled and poisoned and beaten to death in extraordinary numbers, which we wouldn't really see today, except perhaps against the cane toad, their status as a uniquely Australian animal was starting to be claimed by Australians at the time. So, for example, at international exhibitions, Australia consistently represented itself through some form of kangaroo imagery, such as trophies and exhibition sculptures. And the Princess of Wales was a very lucky recipient of a gift, I'm not sure was on her wedding registry, of kangaroo-shaped spoons. So we can see Australia is really starting to take hold of this kangaroo, even though it's a pest and even though it's a bit weird. And I think one of the most telling incidents from around this time is when the princes Edward and George visited in 1881. And whilst it was one thing for Australians to go out and hunt kangaroos, when the princes tried to do it, they were publicly lampooned in the press as not being Australian enough to understand how to hunt kangaroos, if that makes sense. And in my way of looking at it, I think it's sort of similar to complaining about your own family. It's okay when you do it, but as soon as someone else does it, you say, no, no, that's not okay. And that process involves very conscious claiming of the kangaroo, I think. It may be annoying, it may be weird, but it was our weird, annoying animal that we wanted to kill, but we still loved, nonetheless. So I think from the late 19th century, this effort to claim the kangaroo as an international symbol of Australia began in earnest. And this was achieved through both protecting the image from outside incursions, such as with the princes, and also more of an organic process through attaching a uniquely Australian meaning to the kangaroo. Perhaps stemming from its days as a pest, one emotive response frequently associated with the kangaroo was a spirit of irreverence. Jack the Boxing Kangaroo became a national celebrity in the 1880s, when, to the delight of audiences all across the nation, it would fight humans in a boxing ring. And papers at the time declared that this Jack the Boxing Kangaroo represented the true irrepressible colonial spirit, because no country but Australia would, and I'm quoting from newspapers here, dare upset the theories of naturalists by birthing such an ambitious and unusual animal. Now, I'm not sure that was Jack's ambition, because pretty much it was quite an awful scene. They put boxing gloves on a kangaroo and hit it in the face until it tried to kick people. But this image of the kangaroo as this ludicrously sort of heroic creature was set in stone. And even though Jack died an understandably early death, I think his spirit arguably lives on and was reborn perhaps in the 1968 series Skippy the Bush Kangaroo. Now I'm going to try and be a bit technological here for one moment. So excuse me. Here we go. Now, this is a compilation when they re-released the DVD of Skippy the Bush Kangaroo a few years later. Just give you a general glossing over of what kind of things Skippy was capable of.
Righto, boys. One, two, three.
Hibbity-hop, she'll stop the traffic when she passes by. You'll stop and wish that you were where she's going. Hoppity-hip, she'll skip into your heart. You'll wonder why the world is all a glimmer and a glow. She's up the way, she'll wave goodbye. That's when you'll want the whole wide world to know that you love Skippy. Skippy, Skippy the Bush Kangaroo. Skippy, 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 our friend ever true.
Yeah.
Oh, that is Skippy.
So buy it now, guys, out on DVD. It's a great, great series. But as we can see from that short clip, Skippy was just amazing. He was friends with humans, he was friends with koalas. We didn't get to see him flying a helicopter, which he did sometimes. We saw him in his scuba gear, but he was quite a swimmer as well. He could dive, he could send Morse code. He could really carry his end of a conversation, which I think is quite impressive. He was a consciously created national product which built on familiarity with the kangaroo and its previous history within Australia. And the series had massive international success, similar to the Crocodile Hunter today, and a number of parodies, such as a very successful British takeoff, Skipinda, the Punjabi kangaroo, on Goodness Gracious Me. Competing with this spirit of irreverence, the kangaroo also became associated with an ambiguous, if not noble, spirit of Australia. And in this manifestation, which was articulated in books such as Dot and the Kangaroo, where I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with the book, it's where a lovely kangaroo rescues a small child from the bush and is very friendly to her. Kangaroos were wise, special, endearing, valuable, and they were triumphantly Australian. And this dignified and trustworthy kangaroo hopped right on board with the Australian Air Force, which would regularly paint kangaroos, boxing kangaroos in particular, on the sides of their planes in the Second World War, and adopted the kangaroo as their official insignia following the war. And we see here, for example, Sapper Thompson of the Australian Bomb Disposal displaying their unit mascot, Joey, which is actually a joey. And Qantas capitalised on these associations from 1944 when it painted on the side of its planes the kangaroo, which was originally from the one penny coin. And this was initially to celebrate the new kangaroo route from Britain to Australia. But by the end of the war, there was an indelible link between service to the country, flying, and the kangaroo. And today, Qantas still trades on this image of itself as a spirit of Australia. And the spirit of Australia is intangible and flexible. It's a kind of vaguely noble sentiment that's contemporary and timeless. To quote Qantas's marketing department, the kangaroo as a symbol is at once a legacy, the Anzac spirit, free-spirited and confident. And this self-proclaimed bestowal of the Anzac spirit onto a commercial airline simply by painting a kangaroo on the side, I think it should be admired for its audacity, and it couldn't have been achieved without such an effective and emotive symbol behind it. And such sentiments are still echoed by Tourism Australia, who adopted the kangaroo as its symbol in 2004 because it represented, and again I'm quoting from their marketing department, warmth, optimism and boundless energy. And the Made in Australia campaign, which you might be familiar with, it's a triangular green one, adopted the kangaroo in 2006 because according to extensive market research across all of Australia, kangaroos had associations of the pure and natural, unique, innovative and, strangely enough, clean kept on coming up. So these shifting associations demonstrate that the kangaroo has been successfully transformed from a mere animal, which is a huge pest in Australia, into a powerful and ubiquitous symbol. Anyone can write their own Australia onto the animal as long as you meet the precondition of being Australian. And few symbols had more humble beginnings than attempted extermination, and I would argue that few symbols are so self-consciously constructed today as the kangaroo. So I'd like to leave you now with some stirring words from a truly awful poem written in 1819 by Baron Field for the book First Fruits of Australian Poetry. Baron writes, "Kangaroo, kangaroo, thou spirit of Australia. Kangaroo, kangaroo, thy forehalf, it would appear, has been borrowed from a small deer, such as liveth in a tree. By thy hinder thou should be a large animal of chase, bounding o'er forest space, joined by some divine mistake none but nature's hand can make. Kangaroo, kangaroo, nature in her wisdom's play on creation's holiday. For, howsoe'er am anomalous, thou yet art not incongruous, repugnant or preposterous. Better proportioned animal, more graceful or ethereal, was ne'er followed by the hound, with 50 steps to thy one bound." Don't worry, it's nearly finished. "When sooty swans are once more rare, and duck moles the museum's care, be still the glory of this land, happiest of kangaroo, kangaroo, work of the finest hand." Thank you.
It's in your blood, isn't it? Well, thank you very, very much, Linda, and thank you for that beautiful poem, which it's a fantastic poem. You'll put that up on the net for us, won't you, so that we can all enjoy that wonderful poem. We now move on to The Rainbow Serpent with Dr. Shino Kanishi. Shino is a research fellow in the Australian Centre for Indigenous History at the Australian National University. Her research, including her PhD thesis from the University of Sydney, examines Western representations of Aboriginality, and she is particularly interested in the history of cultural contact. She recently co-edited a special issue of Borderlands e-journal on Indigenous bodies in 2008. So please welcome Shino to tell us about the rainbow serpent. I'll slither off now. Slither.
I'm going to be a bit indulgent and not only and talk about myself a bit in working through the symbol. So in 2007, when I was first invited to write about the rainbow serpent for the Symbols of Australia book, I welcomed the opportunity to explore what I assumed to be a lighter aspect of Aboriginal history. At the time, I'd been teaching Indigenous Australian Studies at the University of Sydney, and I was increasingly weighed down by the kind of heartbreaking details of teaching Aboriginal history, going through details about colonisation, dispossession, racism, exclusion, and continual governmental intervention, as we'll probably all remember from 2007. So in thinking about the rainbow serpent, I thought this should be a bit of fun, in contrast, and my mind immediately conjured up sort of images of brightly coloured snakes that I'd seen slithering over the covers of children's books and school murals in my youth, not to mention the array of souvenirs that I'd idly perused at airport gift shops. Yet, at the same time, I knew that the rainbow serpent was more than just a benign attempt to introduce children and tourists alike to the rich cultural heritage of Australia's Aboriginal people. It was not simply a familiar design or decoration. I also remembered that the rainbow serpent could be a symbol of contention that could divide Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. So I guess quickly I went from thinking about light and, you know, colourful histories and went straight into the political. So the first time I'd actually thought about the rainbow serpent as opposed to just sort of, you know, noticing its sort of colourful depictions. Oops. There's an example. Was in the early 1990s when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Western Australia in Perth. Each day I'd catch the number 72 bus, which sped along Mounts Bay Road, only to slow down as it passed the Old Swan Brewery, which kind of lies between Mount Eliza and the Swan River. Because at the time there were always picketers and protesters sort of, you know, out front of the building. And they were protesting the proposed redevelopment of the site by the erstwhile WA Inc. So since the late 80s, the local Aboriginal people and their supporters had declared that this part of the Swan River was a sacred site known as Gunaninanup, a resting place for the Woggle, or the Noongar people's rainbow serpent. The Noongar believed that the Woggle created the Swan River and its waterholes, and according to the elder Clary Isaacs, it has the power of life and death and demands the respect due to it. However, at that time, few non-Indigenous people were prepared to pay it any such respect. Skeptics clamoured to be heard on talkback radio, accusing Aboriginal people of being troublemakers and inventing the Woggle in order to stymie economic progress. Few Perth residents would have been aware that the first government translator, Francis Armstrong, had actually observed Noongar people paying their tribute to the Woggle in 1836, a mere 7 years after the colony had been established. In the end, though, the Noongar people and their supporters lost their claim, and in 1992 the developers began construction on the site, and in 2001 it opened up as a cafe and function centre. So in this instance, the rainbow serpent symbolised the divide between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples' investment in the land and also the clash over Aboriginal peoples' cultural sovereignty. Yet in 2001, so if we move forward, following the legal recognition of native title and also the growing support for the reconciliation movement, which culminated in hundreds of thousands of people across Australia participating in Walk for Reconciliation in 2000, The rainbow serpent had suddenly come to symbolise the unity of the nation. As the nation celebrated the centenary of federation, the rainbow serpent was seen in an array of public displays. Alongside the Federation Star, the rainbow serpent lit up the Sydney Harbour Bridge in the finale of the New Year's Eve fireworks extravaganza. The two symbols together signifying 100 years as a nation, thousands of years as a land, was the slogan. It was also afloat in Sydney's Journey of a Nation Centenary of Federation parade on the 1st of January. And here in Canberra, plantings of tulips and native flora arranged to resemble a rainbow serpent represented the 1970s in Floriade's Century of Bloom display, symbolising Australia's Aboriginal heritage. So in the new millennium, the rainbow serpent was used by event organisers to symbolise Indigenous Australian people, and audiences were urged to embrace Indigenous people's newfound place within Australia's national identity. So in these three different examples, we see that the rainbow serpent was used in fairly simple ways to stand in for Aboriginal culture, or else to highlight Aboriginal people's intransigence, in the case of the Swan Brewery protests, or their eventual acceptance. However, in researching this chapter, I soon realised that the rainbow serpent had a rich set of complex meanings that were completely new to me. By the time I started writing this essay, I was a research fellow at the Centre for Historical Research here at the museum. And so I had fantastic access to the NMA's collections of images, and especially images that were used in a collection called Painting the Land Story, which was edited by a former curator, Luke Taylor. So seeing these images and using these images to sort of trace a new history, I discovered that the rainbow serpent is an English word, obviously, but it represents was the English name for a figure which appears in the dreamings of many different Aboriginal language groups across the continent, such as Thuwathu, Yingana and Nyalon, which I have an image of. It features variously as an important creator figure, a guardian of sacred places, a bringer of monsoonal rains and storms, or else a dangerous creature which lurks in waterholes, threatening to swallow any unwary passerbys, to name just a few of its diverse incarnations. The rainbow serpent is also frequently connected with fertility, both human and ecological. In all of its guises and geographies, it is associated with both water, an essential resource, and also the rainbow, whose shimmering light and curved form reflects the scales and body of the snake. The rainbow is also an important bridge between the water and the sky, which is yet another resting place for the rainbow serpent. So through writing this chapter, I've come to realise that the rainbow serpent symbolises so much more than just the brightly coloured snakes I remember from the 80s. It has been an important symbol in Aboriginal society for thousands of years, judging by some rock art. And by the start of the 21st century, it was also a recognised symbol for the wider Australian society. In making that transition, it had, however, lost its particular so-called traditional meanings and its ambiguous combination of creative and destructive forces. Within contemporary Aboriginal society and politics, the rainbow serpent became an emblem of a pan-Aboriginal identity, unifying all Indigenous people across the country. Unlike any other Aboriginal dreaming figures or ancestral beings, the rainbow serpent was adopted by non-Indigenous people, albeit in an altered, somewhat domesticated form, which I think that image represents. In an official capacity, it's been used to represent the antiquity of the land, unity of the nation, and reconciliation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. But I always remember that cynicism about the woggle when I was a teenager. Individuals have also embraced the rainbow serpent as a positive sign of New Age spirituality and connection to the earth. The rainbow serpent now often evokes social harmony and the acceptance of ethnic and cultural differences, yet at the same time it's also been received by non-Indigenous people with some scepticism and as a symbol of Aboriginal culture's incompatibility with Western modernity and capitalism. It is evident then that the supple skin of the rainbow serpent provides an ideal canvas for inscribing new meanings and symbolisms for Australians, both Indigenous and not, well into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, I was kind of... Because I've got to tell you, doing this, you must do it every day for 5 minutes, okay? It doesn't matter what they tell you on late-night television about exercise machines and what they tell you at the Elderly Citizens Club on Thursday afternoon about keeping fit. Bounce like a kangaroo. It will reinvigorate your life and bring you joy and happiness guaranteed, and it's free. So thank you very much, Sheena. You can see from our list of presenters, we're down now to Richard White, who is going to talk about Cooey and that damnable opera house. So let me tell you about Richard White, co-author or co-editor of Symbols of Australia. Richard teaches Australian history and the history of travel and tourism at the University of Sydney. He is the author of Inventing Australia, Images and Identity, and is co-editor of a number of books, including Memories and Dreams, the Oxford Book of Australian Travel Writing, and A Cultural History of Australia. In 2005, he published a collaborative work, On Holidays, A History of Getting Away in Australia, and in 2007, edited a special issue of Studies in Travel Writing in Australia. He co-edited this. He co-edits the Journal of a History of Australia, and obviously Symbols of Australia as well. So please, on the count of three, a big cooey for Richard White. Are you ready? Now get into it. You people have been lazy and self-indulgent all afternoon, and now it's your turn to make a contribution. Are you ready? One, two, three. Beautiful, Richard White.
Well, thank you, Rod. And for stealing my thunder, I was going to ask for a...
There is
something special about a mass cooey that I always... I often try in my lectures where, you know, often there'll be a few international students, you know. And so I ask the Australian students to demonstrate, and the international ones look on very, very bemused. And then when I ask them to do it, you know, because they will have learned how to do it, there's always total silence. OK, well, why the cooey in a book on symbols of Australia? Because, of course, the cooey is not a visual symbol, as most of the symbols in the book are, and it's what we usually think of in terms of a symbol, but it's an oral symbol. But nevertheless, we wanted to have something that wasn't a visual symbol in it. And we were thinking, well, you know, could you have oral symbols of nations? And if you think about the Swiss yodel or of Big Ben and the chimes of Big Ben as a sort of symbol of Britain, especially Britain, of course, in wartime, they are also very evocative symbols. And, of course, also Australia has the Kookaburra as well. And the two things I think that are crucial in a symbol being effective is that, first of all, it's distinctive, and the cooey fulfills that, and the other is that it's reasonably reproducible. And although, as sort of my international students sort of demonstrate, it often takes a bit of effort to do your first cooey, ultimately, it is a reasonably reproducible thing. But at the same time, I mean, I think it's interesting that the cooey does also take on a visual form, and here we have a sort of wonderful example of the cooey. You know, it requires that particular kind of stance, you know, with the hands held to the mouth, and also, of course, leaning forward, you know, because that means it will carry just that extra 10 centimetres further. Which, you know, and the carrying power of the cooey is, of course, the essential feature of it. The other issue that the cooey brings up in terms of the way in which symbols work, and sort of thinking more abstractly about the nature of a symbol, is the issue as to whether symbols are actually, in a sense, imposed from above, or whether they organically arise, you know, from popular culture, from the people themselves. And I think, you know, different symbols work in different ways in that regard. You know, some are, you know, very effectively exploited by commercial companies, as we've seen, you know, with Billy T. But others sort of seem to just emerge out of the Australian ether, if you like. And in many ways, I mean, the Kui does emerge in that way. It is another borrowing from Aboriginal culture, but it quite rapidly, unlike the rainbow serpent, which, as Shino says, you know, only fairly recently became symbolic of Australia as a whole, the Kui quite rapidly became sort of naturalised within European Australia. Even by the 1920s, by the 1820s, people were, the Europeans in Australia were quite unselfconsciously using the Kui among themselves. They'd started using the term within Kui, for example. That had sort of entered the language. And, you know, from then on, it sort of took off and increasingly became symbolic of Australia. And by the late 19th century, it was being used widely to promote particular companies. It became a brand name and so on. It was widely used in literature. Lots of sort of stories about kuis for lost children, or sometimes quite romantic ones where the kui might, you know, cross the ocean, for example. There's also a series of kui songs from about 1860. I've counted over 70 of sort of popular, you know, parlour songs which use the kui. And of course, the kui being musical, it could be used quite effectively in that way. But in terms of the top-down or the bottom-up popularisation of the kui, I want to introduce you to Maud Wordsworth James. And she's a very interesting character. Actually, I do have an image of her. That's sort of one of the many songs. Kui Mary, My Little Gum Tree Queen. That's my favourite one, I have to say, and there are some wonderful lines in it. But some were, you know, rather more serious kui songs. And, of course, you know, in a way, the sort of climax of the kui as national symbol comes in the First World War, when the kui becomes the call to arms, and it was widely used in recruitment. But turning to Maud, fascinating woman. Maud Wordsworth James was also draws attention to the fact that in terms of nation-making generally, men are sort of generally the prime movers. But when it comes to particularly the sort of popularisation of national symbols, often you find women are actually involved just as much as men. You can, for example, think about the Eureka flag with the Southern Cross was actually first, you know, made by a group of women. The popularisation of the wattle as a national flower was largely down to women. And I think, to some extent, the popularisation of the kui was largely down to Maud. She grew up in Ballarat of a sort of fairly prominent legal family, but during the 1890s depression ended up in Kalgoorlie with her husband Charles, or Charlie. And she had aspirations, and the family was having money problems. And I'll quote her diary because I think it's a sort of fascinating document in national symbology. One night, Charlie came home in a pessimistic mood and talked as though money were the great thing in life and that it weighed more with people than anything else. And when I went to bed that night, I determined that I would not rest until I had thought of some plan for gaining wealth as quickly as possible. Just as the dawn was breaking, an idea came to me that immediately arrested my attention. Here is the idea, which is entirely my own. The Commonwealth of Australia has no souvenir. Tasmania tempted tourists with little golden maps. West Australia sold silver swans on spoons and brooches and jewellery intended for gifts, and the other states sent away kangaroos and emus and typical products of the country. But a present that embraced all the states, and she was a keen federationist too, and which could be used in any one of them, was, I meditated, the one thing needful. And so she hit upon the idea that she'd make her fortune out of the Kui by using it as sort of the inspiration for a line of souvenirs. And to quote the diary again, "The more I thought of it, the more I wanted to jump out of bed and start the thing right away. And from that day to this, I have tried to advance the idea and to make out of it a satisfactory profit for the future." And what she did was register the word as a trademark in Australia and Britain and New Zealand. She patented various jewellery designs, particularly with her kui snake as a sort of design for jewellery. She sold those designs for engagement rings, bangles, brooches. She tried to even claim copyright of the world of the word, but was unsuccessful in that. But she moved on to kui mementos, knickknacks, china, pottery ware. She ran kui competitions. She even made up these excruciating kui jokes. She thought every home should have its own kui corner, and that could include a clock that, rather bizarrely, featured, to quote, "a mechanical blackfellow with boomerang in his hand who would emerge on the hour and half hour and kui." And she also contributed to the songwriting tradition, and she had very interesting things to say about how her song should be sung. Before the singer commences, three kuis, I mean, we only did one. There were suggestions that Australians should, instead of giving three cheers, we should give three kuis. But three kuis, clearly rendered and to carry well, must be given with the hand or hands to the mouth in true Australian fashion. And the compositions should never be sung until the call is thus emphasised beforehand. Maud really got into the kui and popularised it widely. And I think, you know, probably she went overboard. And I think partly because of her, I think because of that excess, you know, almost, we see through the 20th century the kui beginning to fall out of fashion. And one of the other interesting things, I think, about symbols generally is the way that they more or less come and go. Although I suspect, and especially from your wholehearted kui then, I suspect the kui's ready to make a comeback. And interestingly, at Steve Irwin's memorial service, there was a kui. And in a way, that sort of harks back to the idea that the kui had almost supernatural power and could cross the ocean, as England called to Australia for help in the First World War, but also could even cross the grave. OK, now I also half wrote the chapter on the Sydney Opera House, and so I'll just half talk about it very quickly. I think just on, yeah, I mean, I'm going to, it is oppressive for Rod sitting here, you know, that we're going to now talk about the Sydney Opera House, having started with the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But I'd just make the point, Rod, you know, and we make this in the introduction as a sort of sop to Melburnians in many ways, that it's only the fluffiness of Sydney that requires symbols of Australia, whereas a city with substance doesn't need them.
Bless right? you.
And I think where that leaves Canberra, which is, you know, in many ways a city of symbols, you know, and a symbol in itself, I'll just leave that aside. Again, as I said, you know, one of the important things about a symbol is that it's distinctive and, you know, easily recognisable. And I think, you know, certainly the Opera House has the reputation of being the most recognisable building in the world. I mean, and that's, you know, quite a a significant thing. And you know, a number of people will not just Australians, and not just Sydneysiders, in fact, will say it's the most famous building in the world. And I think you know, this Kendone image is a sort of quite a striking one because it doesn't really look like the Opera House, and yet just those sales, from just that image, we know what it's referring to. And similarly, you know, with the Sydney Olympics, just that squiggle was enough to evoke the Sydney Opera House internationally. And that is an indication of just what a powerful symbol it is. But the other interesting thing, I think, about the Opera House as a symbol and about its fame is that a lot of that fame came about because of the controversy that surrounded the building of the Sydney Opera House, the effective sacking of Jørn Utzon in the 1960s. And we tend to sort of forget, you know, once the Sydney Opera House was opened, you know, it became a sort of a symbol of sort of unity, and you know, everyone you know wanted to be associated with it. But we tend to forget that there was not only a lot of criticism of the Opera House as a white elephant and so on, but there was also a lot of satire directed towards the Sydney Opera House. You know, Barry Humphries was you know quite interesting in terms of what he had to say. He saw the Sydney Opera House as basically just a bit of kitsch, and you know he made the most of that. And the final point I'd make about the Opera House as a symbol is that partly because it did become such a powerful symbol of Australia, it also became a site for symbolism, for both you know national celebration, of course, but also for protest, and sort of perhaps most famously with the No War protest in 2003, which, like all good symbolic acts, got turned into a snow dome, which is a fairly rare item, but nevertheless you know, a typical symbol of Australia. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. thank you very, very much, Peter. That's fantastic. And the idea that the Kiwi could make a comeback is just brilliant. If we get timed local calls, I'm sure the Kiwi will make a comeback. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I notice a few of you have to go. We thank you for coming, and you enjoy your safe trip back to wherever you come from. I'm going to invite all our speakers now to the stage, and we're going to open the floor to you for both question and comment. So please, if our speakers could take their allotted positions in front of their name tags. And we have some roving microphones, yes. Liz has one there. There is another one up here as well. Thank you. So, look, this is your chance to engage in this discussion. It has been very, very interesting so far. From my point of view, I found the idea of Maud Wordsworth James's commitment to create something out of the Kiwi extremely interesting, and I'm going to ask Richard. Is it possible to deliberately go out and create a symbol, or is it really a bit of potluck?
Yeah, I don't think you can deliberately go out and create it. There needs to be a resonance there. But I think you can do a lot towards popularising it, getting it to you know proliferate within the community. I think you know Vegemite, for example, is a good example where the company you know happened on the fact that it was getting a sort of response from Australian community, particularly I think you know one of the elements of Vegemite's popularity is the knowledge that nobody else but Australians can bear it. And the way a symbol, of course, distinguishes Australians from the rest of the world is always very important. But then at the same time, the marketing by Kraft, another American company, was very important in the popularisation of it as an Australian symbol. You know, so I think that the two things work together, and I think probably a bit of both is needed.
And look, just either to you or Melissa, because you seem, you overarch all of this, the difference between an icon and a symbol.
You can have that one.
yeah, OK, thanks, Melissa.
I think one of the things about a symbol is that proliferation and the reproducibility of it. I think an icon, you know, the power of an icon resides in the original, right? Mm-hmm. The power of a symbol resides in the fact that the reproduction is as important as the original. And if you think of, you know, something like the coat of arms, for example, there's no original. It only exists as a sort of symbol that's reproduced. Mm-hmm. So that would be my short answer.
Okay. Now, do you have any questions or any comments that you would like to make, or indeed any suggestions? If this book is as successful as we hope it will be, there will be a second edition. You may be referenced as one of the people who contributed to it. So this is a chance. So anything you'd like to add? Yes, right in the middle here. Thank you.
If I can be permitted a double bunger, the first part is I'd like to know one of those awful cooey jokes, and I'd then like to know how much food is there in the book, please.
Look, you really don't want to know one of the jokes. And I'm not sure I can even remember one. There's one about the difference between a cooey and a bad shot at billiards. I'm sorry, I can't remember. But I'll tell you, I mean, she does actually tell a story, and I think it can't be true, about how a notorious criminal had escaped from Australia and managed to get to Britain. And the police were sent looking for him, and they couldn't find him anywhere until this particular detective thought, oh, well, I'll go down to the Strand and Cooee. And the criminal, naturally, you know, any Australian, if they hear a cooey, is obliged to cooey back. He cooeyed back and was caught. I mean, she tells it as a sort of true story, but, I'll leave you to decide. And
in terms of
food? Yes.
Well, we have the pavlova. And, I mean, there could have been other items of food and Vegemite that we had.
And shark. And kangaroo.
Well, yeah, if you want to consider them food in that way, yeah. I mean, pavlova was chosen, I suppose, over the Lamington because of the interesting debate about who actually owns the pavlova between Australia and New Zealand. So it sort of raised lots of fascinating questions there. But, I mean, you know, you could probably have a whole book just on food symbols in a way. I guess I'd be interested in what food symbols people would pick, if there's one you'd favour. Yeah.
Do you have a food symbol? Lamington.
Right.
Okay. Is the Lamington, is it a national thing, the Lamington?
Yes.
It is. Jeff Kennett introduced the Lamington competition in Victoria when he was losing votes in the country. He decided to become a country person. Yeah.
I mean, you could have the Anzac biscuit as well, but we did have the digger, so the biscuit got talked about in that context. Yeah.
Yes, here. Thank you.
I'm not sure how fruitful it is to talk about why something has not become a symbol. You know, we've talked a lot about the things that have, and it gets back to the Melburnian question. The great exhibition building in Melbourne, built for the 1880 exhibition. How is it that Melbourne has never turned that into a major symbol? Why do we think that is so?
Well, they say it's the finest Florentine dome in the Southern Hemisphere, Not that there's a lot in the Southern Hemisphere, but it's that. I don't know. It's I mean, obviously the panel can speak, but as a Melbournean, it's always been part of our life, because it's been the place where the home show and the motor show and all of these commerce events have been held. But I think it's lost its relationship to its original intent, as it's lost the complex of buildings that were around it. It once had an aquarium, it had a science museum, it had a ballroom, it had the most magnificent gardens, and all of those over time, I think the aquarium burnt down, which is a great thing for an aquarium to do. That's really a difficult thing to do. And it's been stripped of its ballroom and so on, back to the basic cruciform shape that it has now. I don't know why. It's a staggeringly amazing building, but it's made of timber, and I suspect, you know, perhaps you don't make a symbol out of something so intrinsically flammable. I don't know. Any comments from there?
I'll have a go at answering the question. I've thought about it for one personal and one professional reason. The professional reason is that my colleague David Dunstan edited a very handsome book on the exhibition building, and it's now on the World Heritage Property Register. The personal reason is that my father spent about 3 years on a radar station in New Guinea during World War II, but he's fond of pointing out, as a Queenslander, that the worst thing that happened to him ever in his life was living in the exhibition building for 3 months while being trained during World War II, and it was unheated. My explanation would be a lot to do with landscape setting. The thing about the bridge and the Opera House is the extraordinary landscape setting. So it doesn't have a landscape setting that lends itself to depicting it in a landscape. Unlike the Eiffel Tower, when you look at all of these other buildings, the landscape setting of them is always incredibly important. Obviously, it is with the Eiffel Tower because the city around it's lower, until you get to La Défense and all that crap, but still. The Empire State Building still has a landscape setting in its part of Manhattan because all the other high stuff's up the other end. And it didn't capture, to me, it doesn't capture a particular point. It sort of, you could say, captures marvellous Melbourne at a particular point, but it, for some reason, that hasn't had any resonance in the long term. I mean, I briefly argue in my chapter in the book, which I think the editors kindly didn't knock this bit out, that the exhibition building just wouldn't be recognised in the rest of Australia. Rod's right, Melburnians know it well, but you go outside Melbourne, you show a photograph of that building to a kid anywhere else in Australia, they won't pick it.
But at the time it was built, it would have been.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And it would have been recognised around Australia at the time it was built, which goes back to Richard's point about the kind of the trends in all these structures. They often lose popularity, they're regarded as utilitarian, then they kind of make a comeback again.
Well, the other thing, I think the Opera House is up there. The difference between the Opera House and the exhibition buildings is the exhibition buildings are practical, useful and serve a purpose. The Opera House, if the Opera House had become a symbol, it would have become a white elephant. Anyway, anything else? Right up the back there, wouldn't you know?
Of the symbols discussed today, the rainbow serpent seems to be the slightly odd one out. I wonder if it is truly a symbol of Australia or if it's a symbol for Aboriginal Australia.
Well, I think, I guess maybe Richard and Melissa could explain a bit why they chose the rainbow serpent. But I suppose what I tried to argue is that there is this sort of self-conscious attempt in 2001 to search for a symbol that could kind of, you know, represent a sort of reconciled Australia. And so, you know, through a series of public displays, the rainbow serpent was used to show the new, you know, the new Australia, which has a sort of reconciled Aboriginal you know, community, or where white and black Australia had been reconciled. So, but I mean, I don't think I found a lot of sort of uses of the rainbow serpent after the sort of Federation. So I guess this would be a question of if it will be continue to be reproduced in that way in the future, or if it was just sort of had its moment around Federation and after the kind of reconciliation walk and those sort of successes.
You mean after the centenary of
Federation? Centenary of Federation.
Yeah, and so, yes, I think it's... I mean, we've organised the book vaguely chronologically according to when a particular symbol emerges as a national symbol, and so the rainbow serpent is the second last one, you know, and the baggy green comes after that. But I think also, I mean, it's a good example again of the co-option of Aboriginal culture into national symbolism, because, you know, as I mentioned, the kui, but also the boomerang, of course, had both been used as national symbols quite early. But both, to some extent, you know, by the end of the 20th century, were sort of falling out of use. And I think, to some extent, yeah, the rainbow serpent has been appropriated, you know, to fill that vacuum of an indigenous symbol that can, at the same time, represent a reconciled Australia. But I think Sheena is right as to, you know, wondering whether it will continue and how successful it will continue to be in the future. But, you know, I mean, things like, you know, Qantas, for example, would use the rainbow serpent, and, you know, it's getting more commercial use. But
I'll be stand here. There we go. Very good.
Yeah, George Poulos. I am the designer of the Bondi Beach flag, as Richard will know. Probably nobody else knows. Have we missed the most powerful symbol of all, which is the rising sun? And we've missed it even in the coat of arms. The rising sun started in the 1820s and signified the new man from the abomination of Britannian man, and then was removed in 1908 from our official coat of arms because the British just came in and said, forget about rising suns, you know, they've only been around for 80 years or something, you know, you can have what we're going to give you, which was one of the ugliest coat of arms we ever had. In 1902, we had the rising sun of the Anzacs, and when I look at this, to me, the rising sun is far and away, like, it's here, and the symbols that are in this book are down here somewhere. Have we missed the most powerful symbol of all?
Just a quick yes or no.
Well, we certainly considered it.
Yeah. I mean, we did consider it, and you know, you might want to say a bit more because Richard's quite interested in the rising sun. So yeah, it was something we did talk about, and we did spend a little bit of time in the introduction talking about it, more so than sort of some other symbols that weren't included, because we did recognise that it was one that could have easily been a chapter. I guess in part because we had the digger, there was some discussion of it there, so that was sort of one reason why it wasn't. But it was one that we did, tussle about.
Yes, I mean, we started off thinking it would be a book of about 15 symbols. The publisher said no more than 20, and ultimately it ended up with 26, you know, which we got it. The publishers aren't here, we can say that. We sort of said, look, we've asked 26 people to write chapters, but probably some of them won't produce, you know, knowing academics as we did. So it would probably only be about 20, and all 26 came in on time, which was terrific. And they went with 26 because we just couldn't find others to drop out. And it was very hard to leave the rising sun out. But I think at the I'm interested that you argue that today it's such a powerful symbol. I think it's a very interesting symbol in terms of the rise and fall of symbols. But I think, you know, in a way, it did fall out of use, particularly, you know, from the Second World War on, with the Japanese rising sun becoming effectively a much more powerful symbol than the than Australia's version of it. I think actually it raises the other interesting question as to why does Australia have so many symbols? And I think that's actually quite an interesting thing to ponder, because I think it's the case that other nations, you know, you can rattle off, you know, 5, 6, 7 symbols of France or America or Britain, but you sort of soon run out. Whereas, you know, I mean, we certainly got to 26 and could have easily have gone, kept on going. And yeah, certainly the rising sun is one of the, our regrets, but not including. Yeah, but
so it is the most beautiful flag in Australia by a long way, and it's sitting there as a really powerful symbol. As well as that, we have rising suns on the crest of the New South Wales arms, on the crest of the South Australian arms, and we have what we call rising suns in vexillology on the fly of the Western Australian flag and the South Australian flag. So the rising sun is rising, rising, rising. It's not falling. And so I would argue that the rising sun is by far and away. But if it's not, I'd like, if possible, for each of you to tell me what is.
Well, my contextual comment is we can't even get our own bloody flag. I mean, we've still got an imperial flag. It's extraordinary.
The Southern Cross.
No, I I'd say the shape of the map of Australia.
I'd probably go the kangaroo for the one that, both within Australia and outside, is able to invoke Australia. Yeah.
Well, obviously, I'd go with kangaroo. But my personal favourite is, I actually wrote a chapter on the crocodile. Someone would like to ask why the crocodile wasn't included as a symbol of Australia. That's also fine. But, yeah, probably kangaroo internationally.
I'd agree with Peter on the map of Australia. I think it's used a lot.
And I think, you know, currently, I think you'd have to say the Southern Cross has more resonance than the rising sun. Look, but I don't disagree with you that it historically has been an enormously influential symbol. And I think it's very interesting in that a lot of Australians don't realise its importance as a national symbol. And it's interesting that the army, you know, in its latest recruiting campaign, co-opted got back to the rising sun as a means of recruitment. So I agree it's still around, but I disagree that it was the most powerful symbol. I mean, we could take a straw poll quickly. how many people would agree with George that the rising sun, how would you like to phrase it, is the most powerful?
Well, the rising sun in its broadest connotation, so you look at the sun in the middle of the Aboriginal flag and say, does that resonate with me? I think that really resonates with Australians, more than the Southern Cross even.
So a better,
and who would agree with that?
So a better question would be, how many of you right now would prefer to see what's loosely called the Aboriginal flag rather than the current one we've got as our national flag? Just as a, I think we need, have we still got our photographer? We need to, I think we need a photograph of the hands up just so we can, you know.
I think, I mean, the other thing about the rising sun, of course, is it's not distinctive to Australia, which is, you know, an issue in, sorry? That's right, that's right. And I think one of the interesting things is the way Australia has laid claim to the Southern Cross, you know, and, I mean, so, I mean,
I don't like to stereotype the young, but I can do that in this audience. Most of them wouldn't realise that anywhere else in the world can see the Southern Cross.
But actually young Brazilians are tattooing as well in the same way young Australians are.
Yes, in the middle up the back there. Oh, we've got a microphone close by.
I wonder whether apart from the tourism...
Oh, hang on, it's a bit hard to hear for everybody.
Sorry. I wondered whether apart from the Tourist Bureau, anybody had done any research as to what foreigners thought were symbols of Australia. All the things we're talking about are patently recognisable here, you know, kangaroos, billies and all that sort of thing, but... Does a billy mean anything to anybody in South America as representing Australia? So, you know, do these icons mean anything outside our boundaries, apart from the oddities like kangaroos?
The way we begin the introduction, if I could just quickly say something, is talking about a probably not very well-known feature film called Scooby-Doo... and the Legend of Vampire Rock, or something like that. Scooby-Doo is an American cartoon. It's a feature film, which is actually set in Australia. It's aimed probably at 10-year-olds internationally. And what they... this group, gang of teenage detectives, arrive in Australia. They climb the Harbour Bridge, go to the Opera House, go to Bondi Beach, get chased by a shark... meet lifesavers, they then go to the outback, they wear a slouch hat, they ride an emu, meet kangaroos, kookaburras, gum trees, right? There's a rock-like Uluru at the centre of the story. I think it's quite amazing, you know, that for 10-year-old Americans, those symbols sum up Australia. And, I mean, you know, the makers must have realised, you know, that they would have resonance even among 10-year-old Americans. You know, so they might not all have resonance, but I think one of the ways national symbols work outside Australia, you know, is through a process of, you know, gradual accumulation of your knowledge of the world, and you acquire knowledge of the world through... imagining symbols. And, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, even for a cartoon for 10-year-olds, the assumption is that those symbols would be recognisable as placing the action in Australia. And similarly, you know, I mean, you know, the Simpsons have had their Australian episode, but they'd also have an episode in France and Japan. And similarly, you know, symbols are working in that way. So I'd say... not all of them, and some... I mean, I think it's interesting that some of these symbols work much more effectively within Australia than outside, but there are others that are more effective outside. I think Foster's is a very interesting symbol of Australia, outside Australia, and is probably more powerful as a symbol of Australia outside than it is inside. You know, and Australians, I think, like the fact that, you know, unlike Vegemite, where nobody else likes it except Australians... with Foster's, everybody likes it except Australians, you know. And I think, you know, the way symbols work to differentiate the two audiences is an important element in it. Anyway, yeah.
When I was doing my research for the kangaroo, I looked into how the Australian Tourism Board chooses what image they're going to kind of run with for the next few years. And they do a lot of market research internationally, and they look for what they called, I think the official term was, semantic markers, which have an emotive response internationally, and so they pretty much flashcard international, and I think they concentrate on key tourism areas like Germany and England and places like that, and they flashcard these things with them and they record their responses to them, and that's quite a clinical way of looking at it. But like Richard says, it kind of boils down to the fact that if you see a kangaroo, you know it's going to be from Australia, or you see the Harbour Bridge, you know it's from Sydney. Those kind of... so in a way, they're quite deliberately constructed internationally, I suppose, if that helps.
We have a couple up the back there, just behind you. Thanks, Liz.
Just with regard to the rainbow serpent, why did you choose that rather than Uluru, which is also, I think, distinctively Australian and has great significance to the Indigenous people as well.
And is in the book. Uluru is in the book, yeah. We have a chapter on Uluru, yeah. And certainly is another interesting example of that use of Aboriginality within a late 20th century, early 21st century context of Australian nationalism. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of the way national symbols are going at the moment.
Yeah. And we have, I think, one. It's just there. Just to your left, Liz. No. Oh, no, you're right, so nothing there. So, they're sprouting like a forest down there.
I noticed in all of the original presentations there were references to advertising and commercial uses of these things. So the questions really are, do we have national symbols or do things remain national symbols if they're not part of advertising, or are we just talking about the history of Australian advertising here?
Very good question.
Have a go.
The example of Qantas, I think, is very interesting because one of my poster artists, Gert Selheim, did the original kangaroo, which they've now abandoned. So I think in the case of... I mean, Qantas has attempted, as we've heard, to kind of, appropriate the kangaroo. I think it's very hard for advertisers to completely appropriate one symbol to themselves. I mean, look at something like the Westpac logo. How bloody dull can you get? Or Ken Doan's, much admired among some graphic designers, Commonwealth Bank logo. Couple of bloody boxes. I mean, so I think the world of logos has become really quite different to the world of symbols, in a sense.
I think there are probably a number of symbols in the book that we look at that don't necessarily rely on advertising too. Something like wattle, which has a popular appeal, or has, again, it's been a symbol that's been revived quite recently in a range of different contexts. A symbol of grief was used as a symbol of grief in aftermath of the Bali bombings and the Swiss canyoning incident with Australians. I mean, so there are ways in which the power of symbols continues without advertising. I think the Pavlova too doesn't necessarily rely on advertising. It's something that's reproduced in people's homes and becomes a symbol that way. Being doled out at the barbecue and. So, yeah, I don't think they necessarily... Lots of them do, certainly, but I don't think it's an essential aspect.
And, I mean, it's interesting that ANZAC is actually legislatively protected from being used by advertisers because of, it's seen as an important symbol. And similarly, there's legislation around the coat of arms or the flag as to how it can be used. But I think, it's a very interesting issue, what is the relationship between advertising and symbolism, and obviously it's very important, more important with some than others.
A classic example at the moment would be the spot of bother that BP's got, because it appears to stand for leaking oil rather than a sun.
And it's also interesting. A lot of symbols sort of proliferated around the turn of the century when there were a lot of the beginning of the 20th century, when there were a lot of very small companies, trying to establish a national market, and they exploited just about everything they could think of as a sort of symbol for their, as a trademark or part of their packaging and so on. And a lot of those have disappeared. Others have been taken over, of course, by multinationals, and the ways in which a multinational company uses the national symbol to sort of, in a sense, naturalise itself. Holden, for example, was always a multinational company, but very effectively presented Holden as a national icon. Vegemite, is another one. And Kraft is actually very, very... I think I can say this without fear of retribution. Kraft is very protective of its image and Vegemite's image. And in fact, we asked Kraft if we could use some of it, of their archival images, and they said yes, we could, if they were allowed to vet the chapter and to make sure it fitted their corporate image. And we said no, naturally, but and found other images. But it's interesting, you know, that they were so concerned about the relationship with the national symbol that they have. Yep.
Your Holden example is very interesting because perhaps it couldn't be a national symbol if it hadn't been presented by advertisers in the way it was.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, because one of the best objects in the National Museum of Australia is the first prototype Holden, which is all Yank. The prototype.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the other interesting thing is, you know, right through the 50s and 60s, Ford was just as popular as Holden, you know, and families, you know, if you remember, you know, families were either Ford families or Holden families. But, of course, Ford got by without any of that national symbol. I mean, their symbolism was that it was American, which was proved just as effective in 1950s Australia as Holden's symbolism that it was Australian.
We'll make this the last because we're about out of time.
The first Ford Falcons were very much... They're always advertising in the bush, in their advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, look, we will have to leave it there. I'm terribly sorry. Please thank our panellists, beginning at my immediate left, Peter Sperrett, Melissa Harper, Linda Thompson, Shino Konishi, and Richard White. Please thank them all. We thank you particularly for coming along. Without you, this would be nothing. And I know that you're going to be invited to the book launch in about half an hour in the Friends Lounge, but that's what's going to happen, so do it.
And a big round
in the microphone. Get in front of the microphone. Be professional.
A big round of applause for our host, I think we'll call him today, the magic Rod Quantock.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.